You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner, Kent, the editor-in-chief, and I'm here with...
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And Allison Constantine, staff writer.
And we're here to talk about various news items. One of them, which seems to be extra theatrical, or it's bigger than just the theater, which is the horrible flooding in Houston and southeast Texas. We'll also talk about another taking on water of another kind, student debt. I guess that was a bad segue. We'll talk about student debt, particularly in the arts. And then we have an interview with Mickey Rowe, who is going to be playing the lead role in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime in a couple different theaters, or just mainly one theater?
It will start September 19th through October 14th is the run at Indiana Repertory Theater, and it's a co-production with Syracuse Stage.
Oh, I gotcha.
And it will then be at Syracuse Stage from October 25th to November 12th.
And this is notable because it's a play about a character on the autism spectrum, and Mickey Rowe, to our knowledge, is the first person actually on the autism spectrum to play the role. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Right? So yes. It's a fascinating interview and sort of a triumphant story. He's done acting before. He was, I think, at Oregon as well?
He's based in Seattle, but he's done a lot of work at regional theaters.
So we're looking forward to that interview. But let's start with, I was actually on vacation, but I think as I was away, we realized that some people were not having a very good time in southeast Texas, and that it was going to affect not just the people of Houston, but the theaters and the art institution of Houston. So Deep and Allison spent last Monday in the midst of right after the landfall and the intense period of flooding, talking to Houston theaters. Tell me what they said.
Deep and I both reached out to a lot of theaters, and we really just didn't know how this was going to go because a lot of the theaters did not have their websites up and running. They didn't have power. They didn't have email. So it was kind of surprising and kind of a game to see who would get back to us.
Right,
but I did. I spoke to 80 Players, Stages Repertory Theater, Classical Theater Company, and I also spoke with Fourth Wall Theater Company. So luckily, because it was easier to have these conversations, I didn't speak to anyone that was really in the downtown area that was severely affected by the flood. But it was hard to have those conversations the day after this was happening.
I know it was very early to have it, but I thought it was better to get a story up.
No, I think a lot of people were appreciative that we were thinking of them.
Right. I think it was also because, and just to backtrack, it was Tropical Storm Harvey that struck Houston last weekend. I don't remember the dates.
It's August 25th and 6th, I think is when the landfall for the 6th, 26th. And 27th, I saw a video on Facebook that Rajiv Joseph, whose play was in rehearsal, he sent a video that he just took with his iPhone of how badly flooded the alley was, just from the outside.
Right, the Alley Theater in Houston, which is located downtown. And so the knowledge that I got from the theaters that I spoke to was that Houston is built on a bayou system. And so, like, the city is a little bit underneath sea level, like, they have a bayou system, so it collects flood water. But there was more flooding than they anticipated, significantly more flooding, like the worst storm that the city has ever seen. And so the bayou's completely overflowed.
Yeah.
And the Alley Theater is located next to a bayou. And so I talked to Dean Gladden, who's the managing director of the Alley, and he said because they're right next to the bayou, like, that entire street was flooded, but it wasn't the entire downtown.
It was mainly
the parts that had the housed the performing arts centers.
I know, because I heard it was the Alley Theater. I don't know the other, the Philharmonic
Let's see. The Alley, there's also the Wortham, which houses Houston Ballet and Houston Grand Opera.
Right.
The Hobby Center for the Performing Arts, which houses Theater Under the Stars.
Okay, wow.
And Jones Hall, which is the home of Houston Symphony. And the sad thing is most of these institutions were flooded in 2001 during Tropical Storm Allison.
No relation to
No relation.
to our current staff writer.
And so, like, just to use the alley as an example, the last time, the last big storm was Allison in 2001, and their entire basement was flooded, leading to $6.5 million in damage for the alley theater, and a $27 million renovation, I believe, according to the Houston Chronicle, which they had just finished. Oh, no, $46 million renovation, which they had just completed last year. And then this happened.
It's brutal for Houston and for the theaters there. We've covered the aftermath of floods, fires, different kinds of disasters on theaters, but nothing, I don't, in my time here, nothing that felt as huge and as important to cover as this one that I can recall.
It's one of those rare times that, you know, the national story and the theatrical story intersect, because it's a lot of theaters that were affected. And then also in the at the bottom of the story that Alyssa and I wrote, we had a list of theaters who are requesting donations, including the Alley Theater, because a lot of their staffers were either stuck in their apartments because there was flooding underneath them, or their homes were destroyed. And so if you look on the American Theater website, you can see a list of theaters.
And there's also a number of theaters that did not have any damage, that were lucky to get away unscathed, that are going to be having a lot of their proceeds of upcoming performances go towards relief. I know AD Players has preview performances starting September 13th, and all the proceeds will be going towards
And what's the victims. Name of the play they're doing?
I don't even want to say. It's Harvey, which is very unfortunate for
the lovable comedy by an invisible bunny. Yeah. It's a ironic coincidence. It's interesting though, those theaters that the quote that stuck out to me, and I think I excerpted on Facebook, was Stages Repertory Theater, the artistic director, saying, "Yeah, our theater is unaffected, but how are people even going to get to our theater?
Like, right.
It's
like a week and a half out, and there's still neighborhoods in Houston that are still underwater.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, on one level, it feels like, you know, there's in some ways more urgent needs than whether a show goes up. But, you know, artists are workers and human beings and audiences too. So it's a part of the story. And of course, it's our part of the story that we cover. So
the heartwarming thing is, like, all of the theaters we talked to, like, all of their staffs were accounted for.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, there were a few people that said their cars had washed away. Just touching base with staff members was their first priority in trying to make sure that everybody was safe. So that was the good news, I think, that we reported out from all the folks that we spoke to.
Yeah, and the Alley, they canceled the rest of the performances of 39 Steps, which was running, but they rescheduled Rajiv's play, Describe the Night, for on campus, University of Houston, I think, a theater there. And then Lawrence Wright had a play called Cleo, which is about the making of Cleopatra. That sounds like a really juicy movie about,
yeah, you know, like Liz Taylor on top of disasters.
Exactly. So they found offsite places for their next two productions.
Because not all of Houston is underwater. There are certain places that are built above ground, and so they are fine.
But you can expect ongoing coverage. I mean, we're updating the list online in our store. You can look for it. It's called Houston Theaters Assess the Damage, or something like that. I forget the name of the headline.
Houston Theaters Survey the Damage.
You can look for that story that Deep and Allison wrote together. And the list at the bottom of places to donate is continually updated and current. We didn't go to update the story because that's a moving target. And
We have another story
coming soon, maybe even by the time this podcast is up, with a sort of update and the sort of longer picture and some of the human story by a writer who's based in Houston. So we were able to do it from the comfort of our New York offices. So anything more to say about the people of Texas? Our hearts and prayers are with them, but anything else?
Send money.
Send money. And some of our money is with them too.
Yeah. Thoughts and prayers are good, but, you know, money is better.
You can't really rebuild something.
Right,
you
don't
send prayers at the store. Right, exactly. So let's see. Speaking of money, nice segue.
I know.
One of our popular stories that we put up recently was about ART, and as a sort of case study of student debt. And it's a story that it's a beat that you've been on for a while. You wrote an excellent story some years ago about how, you know, theater graduates, folks with MFAs and other higher degrees, and even undergrads, how they are coping with student debt. In the case of ART, tell me what went wrong there.
What went wrong? So many things.
At American Repertory Theater, spell it out.
So American Repertory Theater has their School of Advanced Theater Training, which is located at Harvard University. And in January, they were assessed by the U.S. Department of Education, who evaluated hundreds of for-profit schools and certificate programs. And unfortunately, because at the time, even though American Repertory Theater gave its graduates an MFA, it was an international MFA from the Moscow Art Theater with a certificate from Harvard University. So that little wrinkle meant that they were also evaluated, which showed that their graduates amassed more debt than they could pay. Like 44% of their discretionary income after they graduated would have to go towards paying down the debt, which on average was $65,000.
Their average debt.
The average debt load for an ART graduate, and the earnings according to ART, the average earnings for an ART graduate is $36,000.
Right.
So
the Department of Education, they have a formula where if the ratio between what your debt is and what you're expected to make is a certain percentage, then you're kind of on this list of above, you know, I don't know what the
fail. It was a pass fail.
Pass fail
situation. Yes. So ART failed.
They got a failing grade, I guess.
They got a failing grade from the federal government.
Right.
And which put their federal aid at risk. You know, students submit an application for financial aid, a FAFSA, and they get some money from federal government to help offset the cost of tuition, and they would have been at risk of not getting that money if the program was founded to be predatory.
Right.
So American Repertory Theater, they decided to take a 3-year hiatus. They're not taking students starting from fall 2017 in the next 3 years. And they want to come back with a fully funded MFA program.
Right.
So then I've been talking to many, I'm talking to a lot of people at the ART school, and also Diane Paulus herself, the artistic director of ART. And one of the things that was interesting to me, and that was the nut of the story, which it came from Scott Ziegler, who is the head of the ART Institute, and he said that our program was evaluated because it was a certificate program, but if other MFA programs were evaluated, they would fail because.
Yeah, they would likely fail.
They would likely fail.
I get someone should do that study, I suppose, right?
Someone should do that study. I've been having conversations over the years of how that could happen, and I don't even know how you do it,
right?
Because
right.
There's hundreds and hundreds of MFA programs, mm-hmm. and so it got me wondering. Like the press coverage around ART was very much this institution failed its students, but then it made me think. I know so many people with theater degrees, including Allison in the office, who have thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in debt. And so I know just from anecdotal experience that this is not an ART problem. And so why is it still an issue, and why are universities not addressing it? Mm-hmm. And what can be done to address it? And so that was what the story was about.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of as Keith Ziegler points out, it was sort of a fluke. It has a lot to do with the arcane bureaucratic institutional divide between Harvard and ART. It's not technically an MFA. Harvard won't give a theater a degree. That goes
Harvard
back to,
won't give any MFAs.
Yeah. So they set up this institute in sort of a jury-rigged way, as
mm-hmm,
you say.
They did.
And so they were susceptible to this sort of scrutiny, but it's true that other schools, this is a symptomatic of a larger problem. Allison, do you want to talk at all about your experience of
Yeah, student loans are my favorite topic. No, I did not go to graduate school, but I did go to undergrad and received a BA in theater arts and acting. So, and I'm in the throes of paying all that back now. So but Deep Story kind of made me feel a little bit better about it, just because I'm somewhere right in the average there of what people have of debt. But yeah, it's definitely conversations that you don't have in a lot of training programs, which I think that they should from the get-go of kind of what the employment rates are for folks. I mean, I remember hearing a really staggering statistic. I think it was my junior year. We had a business of acting class, which really should have happened freshman year, but junior year we are. And I was told that the average actor working, like an equity actor who has consistent work in New York City, makes $7,000 a year performing.
I remember that.
I mean, that's just like, why didn't someone tell me this before I declared my major? No, but I think they should have a little bit more.
I'm changing my major to
anything
not
else.
Theater.
And I think at my school too, which is primarily it's a business school. They lump in all of their employment rates and all the statistics on their website as being very high. And I just, out of curiosity today, was looking back at my class, graduating class of 2014, and I think it was. It says 86% employment rate, and that includes, you know, the performing arts school is lumped into the arts and sciences kind of umbrella
and
of program.
And sciences
so,
covers
you know,
a lot there.
It covers
a
whole
lot.
Lot
of work
so,
in that pair. Interesting.
But I've just 3 years out have seen a lot of my my classmates going back to school for other things, mm-hmm. moving out of the city. It's, you know, I think it's a shock for a lot of people who intend on pursuing a career in the arts and are struggling to pay their loans, especially if they're in big cities,
right.
which they usually move to.
Well, and here's a question, Allison. Did your program do any cuts? Like,
they did not, which is great. I mean, I cannot imagine having to, you know, take loans out or be part of a program that 2 years in is like, well, you're gone. I mean, it's good that I think there are less and less of cut programs, but they're still out there, and that's kind of terrifying.
Right, because one of the suggestions in the story was, I mean, one of the central issues I found was there's just so many people getting, I'm just going to use one example, acting degrees. There are so many actors, and there's mm-hmm. not enough jobs to sustain them, so mm-hmm. why not start cutting people in, like, the second or third year? So you're graduating with people, there's less people coming out, and it's also people who probably will have less debt because there's more money to be allocated to fewer mm-hmm. students in the fourth year. I mean, it's a very cool way of doing it, but at the same time, there is this central question that Scott and I were talking about, which is, do you provide the education because people want it? Or do you tell them, no, you should not be doing this because it is, the field cannot support you?
Right.
Yeah. Last year, I was working on the January training issue, which focused on musical theater training. And a lot of the directors of programs across the country that I spoke to were talking about kind of this oversaturation of talent. And mm-hmm. they can't, you know, they're figuring out ways of how to audition folks because it's getting to be like, you know, 4,000 kids are showing up to audition. So they're trying to do a lot of culling people out before they even see them in person, like sending in videos and also lessening the spots that are available. So I think that's one way of doing what you're saying too, Deep, is just kind of like getting a handle on how many people are applying and weeding people out from the get-go, and then also just making it harder to get in by making like 15 slots, you know, per program.
It's interesting because it seems like it pushes along some similar pressure points to the argument of overcompensation, because it's, for me, it's always been about access versus equity, the value of allowing anyone in who wants to be part of it, wants to be part of the theater. Like, that's a value. But then you also, once they're in, you want it to be professional. You want them to be paid. You want people there to be enough jobs and enough money for everyone. And those two are in obvious tension with each other. You want to also, if you're going to have people come in and have nice facility, you know, I'm not suggesting that I really come down on either side of it. It's just that I recognize there's this huge demand and desire of people who want to be part of the field, whether it's working or studying. And then how do you make that available to them without in a non-exploitive way? It's also possible for people to exploit themselves, essentially, to willingly be part of a system where they are either in denial about their chances or about how much they're worth. You know, I'm just trying to lump compensation and study together. Or, you know, it's a business. It's all about the dreams and living on your dreams. But, you know, it's actual economic reality for a lot of folks. So did you feel pressure for there to be another degree added? Or do you think if you were pursuing acting, you think, oh, I would have to go back and get my MFA? Or
I think I'm still in the denial of how much I have to pay back for undergrad.
Oh, well, I don't mean you're in denial.
No, I do. I feel like a lot of... I I saw a lot of people who went through the theater arts program who then kind of wanted to work a little bit to see what they wanted to pursue
right.
exactly in if they wanted to go to grad school. So, yeah, I do see value in that. I have a few friends that are just starting grad school this year for mm-hmm. acting.
Right.
So I don't know. I was always at the point where I don't know what I would go back for so why would I?
Sure.
Why would I get into more debt? But
right,
yeah.
Right.
I mean, I've talked to Deep about this because I did not go to journalism school. So just talking to Deep about what that.
Don't you know, do it.
Yeah.
See? Don't do it.
Well, it's worked out for you, Deep, right? Well, it sort of worked out for you. To an extent. You're right.
Well,
okay.
It's like, I mean, if we... if we're going to have a very frank conversation, I think when you go to a graduate program,
yeah.
you're not, I don't think you're paying so much for their training because I think
yeah.
it's one of those things that you, just speaking of journalism, it's one of those things that you can just learn on a job and most valuable skills. I've become a much better writer in the past 5 years post-journalism school. And it wasn't because I studied.
Yeah,
I just
yeah.
did it day in and day out and got better at it that way.
That's
but I
true.
Think you're paying for the access to get into this very exclusive industry.
I suppose
that's
true.
Which is what grad school is for theater, too.
Yeah, that's the Yale School Mafia and all that.
Yeah.
It's true. My wife was just talking. She got a master's in writing. This is another field, but she's getting younger writers coming to her saying, should they get a... It's the same conversation. Should I go to this really cheap MFA that no one knows about because it's cheap? They don't feel like it's like, well, there's a more expensive one that's like the Iowa group, you know, that's going to look better in the resume. And also she'll meet lots of, I don't know. It's a constant push pull.
Whichever gives you the most money
at the end. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to do the calculus on that. I'll just say this makes me all think of Leah Nanaka Winkler's wonderful mm-hmm. piece from a couple last February. I think it was
this February,
this like past February. It feels like a lot. Yeah. 2017. Yeah. About there was a fellow in there, I can't remember his name, who talked about how he just did an MFA type, gave himself an MFA type education on the cheap, just found the professors, took their private courses, just did whatever he could, and
like audited, yeah.
Yeah, audited and just, you know, took a pretty ruthless approach to it because he had to. And I think you look at some of the people in that story, they're not doing great, but they're doing well. They're doing as well as a lot of MFAs I know, and they're making a living and making it work. That was a very practical, hands-on story. Hopefully people will – I think it's very easy to get into a starry mindset about, like, I had this mindset about USC Film School. Like, I have to go. That's the only place I can go. Have to go there, Dad. Got to go to this. And, you know, I'm not making films now. I'm not making the kind of money that a filmmaker might make. But, you know, it's hard to tell an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old. Like, think practically, you know.
Right. Well, I think, but it's one of those things, because the conversation goes back to equity.
Yeah.
About if you're going to make a degree a prerequisite, then
yes.
it needs to be an affordable degree. Otherwise, you close access.
Right.
Because if you're someone like me who came from a very poor background and then you're graduating with, you know, I know people with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, and it just makes me so sad. But, like, you know,
tens of thousands
of dollars in debt, like, that precludes you from taking risk in your professional life. That
right.
precludes you from taking unpaid internships and unpaid work because you cannot afford to. Because if you don't make rent, then there's no one, you don't have a parent to help you pay your rent.
Well, I just want to tease, we have a story in our October issue, an interview with James Bundy, who's the artistic director of Yale Rep and the head of the school there as well, the Yale Drama School. And that was his number one priority when he came in 2001. And they have significantly lowered the debt burden for Yale Drama School. And that's one of the most notoriously sort of like, you got to have the Yale degree. And I think they felt that pressure. And that is a school that's been a leader on that field. So hopefully, and there's some great quotes in his piece, very clear-eyed about what a degree should be worth, the way it's valued in the field, how many people they're putting out in the field. So I'm just teasing that. The story in our October issue will be up online in late September, after this podcast is up. So look for that.
And if you're not Yale, make it free anyway.
Right. University
of California, San Diego is all free, which was mind-blowing for me when
awesome.
I found that out.
So, yeah. So I'm not saying he's a leader in it. So like, I hope other people in the field are taking this seriously. Clearly, the board at Yale were like, this is one of our main priorities, James, when he came in. So, and he was I didn't realize when he was 42 when he took the job in 2001, he'd only been out of Yale himself like 6 years. So he was then managing his former professors. So I'm giving away.
It all worked out in the end.
Any final thoughts on student debt?
Don't go to school unless it's fully paid for.
Okay. Or just keep the debt low.
Keep the debt low.
That manageable, you know. So we're going to go now to Allison's interview with Mickey Rowe of Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Over to you.
So I'm Allison Considine, the staff writer at American Theater, and I'm here with Mickey Rowe, who will be the first actor with autism to portray the character of Christopher Boone in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The play follows Christopher, who's a 15-year-old boy. He's on the autism spectrum, and he tries to uncover the mystery surrounding the murder of his neighbor's dog, Wellington. And the show made its first appearance in the West End, came to Broadway, and it's currently making its rounds through regional theaters, and Mickey will be appearing as Christopher in the co-production between Indiana Repertory Theater and Syracuse Stage. It'll be running September 19th through October 14th in Indianapolis. So, Mickey, I'm just curious how this project came about and what your relationship to The Curious Incident was before this.
Absolutely. Well, I, of course, read the book The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, and I really enjoyed the book quite a bit. And then when Janet Allen and Bob Hupp from Indiana Repertory Theater and Syracuse Stage were deciding on what their production was going to look like, they were so smart and kind to reach out to an organization, Inclusion in the Arts. Do you know Inclusion in the Arts?
Yes, I do, actually.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
so
that's great.
I'm not exactly sure how that connection happened, but somehow Janet Allen connected with Inclusion of the Arts and was given my name as someone to reach out to. I sent them a video audition when they reached out to me, and then they flew the director of the show, Risa Brainin, out to Seattle to meet with me for an hour, and then I found out that I was cast.
That's fantastic.
It really is.
So had you seen any previous productions of the show?
I had. I have seen the Broadway production of the show, which I thought, you know, it's so complicated with what you were talking about a little bit ago, but it was such a good production. I thought it was really well done. The script is brilliant, and I'm so excited to get to do my own take on it, and for Risa and I and everyone on this brilliant, awesome team at IRT to get to reimagine it from scratch in our own way.
That's great. And I saw a Curious Incident, I saw it on the West End a couple years ago, and I remember it being very physical, and there was lots of choreography.
Oh my goodness, so yes.
I was curious how you've been preparing for that and kind of what the challenges are in preparing for a role like this.
So, our first official day of rehearsal is tomorrow. I believe we only have a 2-week rehearsal process before we start spacing and tech on stage. So it's a very quick, nitty gritty, hit the ground running rehearsal process. But so they had me and the choreographer, and Risa. We have been rehearsing for the last 3 days just on our own without the rest of the cast so that we can figure out some of that movement on our own and have extra 3 days to get to do some of that movement before everyone else gets here. They're all arriving from Chicago and other and New York and other places today. So I'm a little sore today, coming out of three 8-hour days of just nonstop movement. But it is so much fun. There's a lot of flying in the space type zero gravity things that we're working on that are really, really fun. There's a lot of rolling and tumbling and diving and handstands and near misses where Christopher doesn't see things that almost happened to him, and I'm really excited.
That's great. And the production that I saw, I think, as well as the Broadway production, kind of conveyed the experience of autism through the set, through the seating, through everything, as soon as you walk in the door of the theater. I know the show I saw, it was like a grid-like set. It's almost as being inside of Christopher's mind. So I was just curious if you had any conversations with the design team or if you've been part of that creative process at all of how to portray autism on stage.
So I our set is so awesome and so brilliant. And I believe that most of the design meetings around our set and things like that had already happened before I was cast in the production. But just being in the room already, there's a lot of things that we've been talking about to make sure that we aren't just reiterating stereotypes about autism, that we're coming at it from a really true, honest, to me, place. There's a lot of scenes where Christopher has meltdowns when he gets really sensory overload. And there's a lot of scenes where he's stimming, which autistic stimming is when you might see someone on the autism spectrum flapping their hands, for instance, is common. Or bouncing or rocking back and forth. Or for me, I usually kind of will hit my leg in a rhythmic pattern or hit my hands together or in a rhythmic pattern. But so we've been trying to make sure that when we do those things, it's not about just being as extreme as we can for the purpose of, I don't know what the right word would be. You know, often with disability right now, the point we're at is when disability is portrayed in the media, it's made very extreme and very over the top and almost to exaggerate differences. And so we're trying to instead come at it from my personal experience, and Risa can say, so Mickey, if you're stimming, what does that look like to you? And then we can build choreography around that from me, a real autistic person who has done that in real life. And so I can then do it on stage in a choreographed way as well. Did that answer your question, or did I just completely go off on a tangent?
No, that was great. You answered it perfectly. That kind of goes into my next question. Well, I've read that you have talked about this before, but your experience of living with autism, you've said that it's been very beneficial to preparing for roles and also performing on stage. I was just wondering if you could share some of those characteristics that overlap in what you do as a professional actor.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think that for a lot of autistic people, we use scripting in our daily lives because this conversation is somewhat easy for me because I have pages of notes in front of me, for one. And for two, we are not in the same room together. We're doing this via Skype. Christopher, at one point in the show, says that he'd make a really good astronaut, but the one sucky thing about being an astronaut would be that he would have to talk to strangers from mission control. And then his solution is, but we would do that through a radio link up in a TV monitor, so it wouldn't be like talking to real people who are strangers. It would be like playing a computer game. So you and I get that benefit here today. But a lot of times for autistic people, social interaction, where the less clear the roles are. So here we have clear roles. You're interviewing me. I'm the interviewee. if we were in a social setting or on the street, those roles wouldn't be there. So it makes it less clear what the expectations are of how to act. So one thing that autistic people do to make their lives a little easier is we just use scripting in our daily lives. So if I go into a coffee shop, I can say, can I have a large coffee, please? And I could ask, has it been busy today? And then no matter what the barista responds, yeah, it's been busy, or no, it hasn't, or whatever, then I can say, oh, do you like it better when it's busy or less busy? So we kind of script conversations that way so that it can seem like we're having a conversation we're coming up with on the spot. And no matter what the other person responds, we can keep on script. And it just makes, it takes the unknown out of trying to have social interactions with people. And that is literally exactly my same job as an actor, where I memorize a script, and then after I memorize the script, I have to say the script and make it feel like it's the first time I'm saying it every time, and convince people that I'm coming up with these words on the spot, and that they're my words happening just specifically because of the interaction we just had, or this specific moment spurred it. Another thing I think with being on the spectrum and acting is the roles are so clear, where they're not in real life. You're never told, oh, look, in this specific situation, here's exactly what the roles are, what your role is in relationship to the other person, and how you guys should interact together. You never know. But on a script, you literally are assigned a role. You're given clothes to wear, and those clothes inform your who you are. Everything is informing your role and your relationship to the people on stage with you. It's written in the script. And then you also know that we're all working together on making this goal happen. And the audience knows you're playing roles. They are in on it. They know what's happening. Everything is so super clear. Makes it really easy in real life, whereas it would not be that way on the street. That's where it's scary. And on stage, everything is really easy and laid out.
That's fascinating. I never really thought of it that way. And you've been involved in theater since you were younger. So I was just curious what that introduction was and kind of how you found your way into performing.
Yeah, so I have always, since I was super little, done magic. And magic was sort of a way to relate to other people, where the roles are, you're the magician and they're the audience, and you could do magic tricks for people, and that's a way to interact on script with the specific relationship. So I was always performing, doing magic since I was little, and then I stilt walk as well. So at one point, the Seattle Opera needed a stilt walker for the magic flute, and I went in and auditioned for them as a stilt walker. I was 10 years old and probably... I was a teeny, 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 itsy-bitsy 10-year-old. The costume itself, this big ostrich costume, weighed 100 pounds and was made for an adult. So I didn't obviously get that, but they called me in for a different show where I got to be a street urchin in Barber of Seville. And then I think I did 8 more shows after that with the Seattle Opera. So that was kind of my hook into live theater.
That's great. And so now playing this role, I did read that that Indiana Repertory Theater is going to be doing sensory-friendly performances of The Curious Incident, which is exciting. So you'll be kind of representing this community in a way, and probably be, you know, an access point for a lot of kids who are on the autism spectrum who have never seen themselves portrayed on stage. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that and what that experience means to you.
Yeah, I think that young artists and actors with disabilities, it's just so important for them to see role models who can tell them that if you're different, if you need special accommodations, and if you access the world differently, then the theater needs you and the world needs you. And that's something that is just sort of a missed opportunity, I think, when we have non-disabled people playing disabled roles. 20% of the U.S. population has a disability, according to the 2010 census. But the Ruderman Family Foundation did a recent report and found that only 2% of disability only has a 2% representation rate in the film, TV, theater that we see. And the worst part is, of that teeny tiny tiny 2%, 95% of those roles are played by non-disabled actors portraying disabled roles. So that leaves, I've tried to do the math and I'm not sure how to do it, but only 5% of 2%, it's like less than 0.1% representation rate for actual disabled actors playing disabled roles. So I think that the point of storytelling is to connect us with people who we otherwise wouldn't come in contact with and to bring us life experiences that we don't already have. And that's why diversity matters in the arts. And inclusion in the arts matters because it leads to inclusion in life. So when this is the first time that an actually autistic person has been included in telling a story about autism, all that means is that we have a lot of good work still left to be done.
That's right. And I mean, for listeners who aren't familiar with Curious Incident, when it was on Broadway in 2015, I believe it was, and prior to that, and its run in the West End, it was pretty controversial surrounding the casting of it. There were non-autistic actors who rotated through the role of playing Christopher. So this is a huge step in the right direction for the theater community. And hopefully as this show rolls out throughout the regions, which it looks like it will be this upcoming season, I hope that more theaters take on this initiative and are, you know, steadfast in looking for these actors who are ready and willing to take on this role within the autistic
community. Absolutely. And even I know that Mixed Blood is doing this show, I think, as well.
Oh, that's
and
great.
I've heard through my agent, who represents a lot of people with disabilities, that they have cast an actor with cerebral palsy, which is so awesome as well. So you can really open your mind up, and if you can't find an actor with autism who you feel is ready to play Christopher, because it is an insanely tour de force. It's just a stupid amount. It's a lot in every which way. Funny, it's just a ton. If you can't find that person, then cast someone else who has it, cast with a different disability, or cast Christopher's father as an older actor who is on the spectrum, or his therapist. You know, you could cast any character in the show as a person with an actor who has autism or a disability, or you could even, you know, our culture loves stories about white male autistic people. I mean, it's just a story that we see over and over again, and we never actually use autistic people when telling these stories, but the Rain Man or kind of autistic savant story with the white male, cisgendered male, is something that we just see over and over and over again. And so if you can't even find someone with a disability to play the role, then you could maybe cast an actor of color as Christopher, and then you're still doing something good for the autistic community, because you're showing people that people of color and women are also just as likely to have autism. Autism is by no means only affects white males, which is what our media would present it as.
Yeah, it's true. I think a lot of theaters are very forward in their thinking of diversity and making sure that there is a lot of inclusion in terms of
absolutely
of race, but also just being mindful of who they're hiring in terms of playwrights and directors and keeping gender parity in mind. But something that kind of crosses all of those different groups is disability. And like you said, with those staggering statistics before, it's just not being represented
no,
or portrayed, really. I mean, there's stories out there about disability and about living different experiences that just aren't being told.
When it also seems like with disability, you know, with other groups, obviously, we know that there's no reason that that people of color, for instance, should be excluded as much as they are. You know, I mean, we understand that we're all the same, basically, and with other groups, we understand that as well. But it seems like with disability, because there actually is a difference with how the person can function beyond just their appearance, mm-hmm. We often feel like, yeah, there is the American with Disabilities Act that says we need equal access, but we actually have legitimate reasons for being concerned about casting someone with autism in this role. Or, oh yeah, well, I know there's the ADA, but they do have truly sincere, legitimate reasons why they cannot include people with disabilities, which we just need to show that people with disabilities can get the job done, and then slowly people realize that they can. There's a lot of awesome theater company, or I'm thinking a family theater company in Denver that is really one of the only ones I know that that casts with disability frequently. I mean, that casts with disability, but it's a specific theater company for people with disabilities only. Mm-hmm. So it seems like we're still at the point now where if you have a disability, great, do theater, but do theater over here with only disabled people, kind of an equal but separate. We can't quite have you at the regional theaters yet, so do your own stuff kind of place.
Right. And I know, I guess it was about 2 years ago, the Casting Society of America formed a diversity committee that has a section focused mainly on how to bring performers with disabilities into the fold and how to just get their names known among the casting communities. And so I'm just curious, too, if you have any other suggestions of how the theater field can be more open and receptive to you know, bringing up new talent and also just finding people out there who are interested in performing.
Yeah, well, I think that step one is just making sure that you, not only are you inviting these people to the auditions, but that your auditions are accessible as well. I know I had a friend who was not disabled, but shared this with me, that they auditioned for a role and the character was in a wheelchair. The character that they auditioned for was in a wheelchair, and the audition was on the 10th story of a non-wheelchair-friendly a non-accessible building. And so it's like, if you know the character you're auditioning is going to use a wheelchair, then one, think, oh, maybe we should actually hire or consider actors who already use wheelchairs, and two, you want to make sure that you're having the audition in a building that's accessible. Me, for example, I'm also legally blind. Autism is often linked with vision or hearing problems, separately, but there's a correlation. And so if I'm called in to an audition, for example, I need for the sides to be large print, 18-point font, sans serif, so that I can read them. And if I show up to an audition and all the sides are only 12-point font or smaller, or they don't have 18-point font, no matter how right I am for that role or how right I am for collaborating with that team, I will never get that job because there's just no way for me to read the sides. And it's so, I think a lot of these accommodations too are so easy. It takes someone probably 30 seconds to just open the document, open the sides on their computer, click select all, change the font to 18 and print off one extra copy, you know? It right. doesn't take any time. It's just that everyone's so busy that if I shoot someone an email saying, I'd love to audition, is there any way that there can be 18-point font sides available for me? Mm-hmm. Most of the time, it just doesn't happen, not for any malice reason, just because people are busy, and who knows if the email even actually ends up going to the right person or getting where it needs to go to make that happen.
Yeah, it seems like such an easy
right.
thing.
And I think a lot of accommodations are really just that simple.
Have there been any accommodations throughout the rehearsal process of Curious Incident that have been helpful?
So I've only had 3 days without the rest of the cast, but they were really great, and I got the script well ahead of time, so I was able to enlarge the script myself. But when we had a little recording session for some voiceover stuff the other day in rehearsal, and I was so amazed because I'd never even had a conversation with anyone about it yet, but the day I showed up for the voice recording thing, the stage manager had all the lines that they wanted me to say for the voiceover recording already printed up in 18-point font on a piece of paper without anyone asking him to do it. He just had printed it that way, which was really, really nice. And then I think that everyone's just been, you know, I usually show up to rehearsal an hour early and have headphones on and sunglasses on, and just because I like getting places early, but I'm not necessarily the best at small talking with people before rehearsal. And so people have just been really nice about waving, but not thinking that I'm being rude by sitting in the corner by myself and not chatting so much, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned earlier sensory-friendly performances. So for people who mm-hmm. don't know about what that is, productions will present a show that has dimmed lights, or they'll cue down some of the sound cues or make things less, things in the show that are overstimulating.
Right.
They kind of
right.
dial it down a bit for productions that are presented for families and children with autism. So
usually they'll leave the house lights up just a little bit. So if someone needs to go into the lobby for a little while during the show, they can do that easily. And I think the biggest thing about sensory friendly performances is, I know a lot of parents who have young kids on the spectrum are just so worried about their kids being a little louder during the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just nice for them to be able to know that they can come to that show and it's okay, and everyone's going to be in the same boat and no one's going to care or get angry if their kid is noisier.
It's true. And it's great that a lot of theaters have been accommodating mm-hmm. audience members and just being aware of these situations and how to welcome all sorts of people into the theater and make it an enjoyable experience for all. And Mickey, I think with your taking on this role, which is, you know, representative and being portraying the autism experience, is really a huge step in the right direction. So I'm hoping that some of these accommodations will filter out from the audience and also be portrayed on stages across the country. So this is really exciting, and this is just a great way for Curious Incident to kind of start off on its rollout throughout the country.
And kudos to regional theater. I mean, I think it says so much to regional theater that Broadway wasn't able to include anyone in the spectrum anywhere in their production. TV shows are coming out every day, like Atypical, which portrays autism and don't include anyone in the spectrum anywhere in the creative team or as any of the actors. And so it just one more time that regional theater shows that it can really lead the way and show the ideal world, show the world how that we want to create in the future.
It's true. And you're at the front lines of that, Mickey. So thank you.
So are you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much. And best of luck with the run. And like I said, it's going to be running September 19th through October 14th in Indianapolis. It's a co-production between Syracuse Stage and Indiana Repertory Theater. So have a good run.
Thank you so much.
And we're back with some recommendations, endorsements, whatever you want to call them. Deep, what do you have to talk about?
Well, I'm going to talk about something that I haven't seen, but I've heard really good things about, and it's touring. So,
okay,
yeah. Well, we shared it today on our
Facebook. It's very relevant too, isn't it?
It's very relevant if we're talking about sociopolitical topics. The theme of this podcast. it's called Deferred Action. It's a production by Caramia Theater Company, which is a Latinx theater company based in Dallas. And it was written by David Lozano and Lee Troll. And it's about a dreamer, a young Latinx person who was brought here when they were very young. And now they're trying to get a job and go to college, and they discover that they're undocumented. And it's about... Being an undocumented person, and the roads that are available to you or are not available to you, and it's related to the news around DACA, the deferred action for childhood arrivals. It played last year, and the show is touring around the country, starting in September 14th through 17th at Southern Methodist University. Then it'll be touring around Texas. Then in October, it'll be playing at Latino Theater Center in Los Angeles.
It's at Los Angeles Theater Center, but the Latino Theater Company. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
LATC, yeah.
Yeah.
That couldn't be more time. I'd forgotten for a moment that... That we'd run that, but I saw the email about deferred actions. Like, yeah, we should reshare our story about that, because that's really, really depressingly relevant. A very dramatic story that hopefully, unfortunately,
we'll
we're not
have
seeing,
a happy ending.
Well, no, I don't know, but we're not seeing the last chapter of it. Basically, it's being written as we
record this podcast.
Unfortunately, Allison, what do you have today?
This is a TV show I just started watching. Binge watched the first season of 13 Reasons Why on Netflix, which is very much a teen show, but it's got some great theater folks in it. Brian D'Arcy James and Kate Walsh play the parents in the show. And it was just announced Kelly O'Hara is going to come on next season.
Wow.
So, I mean, the premise of it is kind of terrible. This teenage girl commits suicide and leaves behind audio tapes detailing and explaining the 13 reasons why she did it. So it's pretty,
how do you do a second season of that?
They're leading up to the parents getting a copy of these tapes. So,
wow,
there will be a lawsuit in season two. That is what has been teased.
Wow. Okay.
I was just telling Allison I cannot with teen shows anymore. I feel like it's beyond my age group.
Yeah, I haven't found it's anyone I know who's watching this show besides me.
I remember full grown adult.
I remember a TV movie when I was about the same age as it. Molly Ringwald and Zach Galligan, I think, played two teens who, based on a true story, who like a teen suicide pact. But it wasn't Romeo and Juliet. It was just did it for the usual. Or no, sorry, not usual, but just sad reasons that teens kill themselves. It was awful. TV movie, but this is a series.
It is a series.
An evergreen topic, sadly.
Yes. Well, that's pretty downer.
Sorry, guys.
Everything's a downer this week.
I'm going to say something that maybe is not a downer, but it's an ongoing story. One of our biggest stories last week, or a pair of stories last week, in addition to the Houston coverage, was Joe Hodge, the director of the Guthrie, artistic director of the Guthrie, wrote an op-ed about turnover. Because there was another piece by John Moore, excellent reporter in Denver, about how much turnover the field is about in the midst of, and about to people announcing retirements. We've seen these waves come in a while. But as baby boomers are either retiring or just moving on to new careers, or different careers. There's a whole list of them. We've talked about them on the show before. But there's something like 20 major theaters of all different sizes around the country that are in the midst of or about to be turned over. Anyway, so we had these great stories about, you know, what the opportunities and pitfalls of this situation are, having all these positions open, and are they going to be turned over to the usual suspects, or are there people in the wings, in the pipeline, as they say, women, people of color, to upset the, because statistics are, you know, statistics for playwrights are like way beyond what they are for artistic directors and managing directors as well. So they've been very dominated by white men. And so is the field ready to change? I will say it wasn't highlighted enough. Some of the quotes from our fearless leader, Teresa Eyring of TCG, was in John Moore's story talking about how she would hope that boards and artistic search firms would remember that a lot of the people who are these venerable figures now, someone gave them a chance to be artistic director years ago. They didn't ask them to show all the theaters they'd run, all the funds they'd raised. And I do think I have some empathy for thinking about the bottom line, like, well, this is a big decision when you run this. Some of these people started and the company was tiny, and now it's this huge behemoth that's worth all this money, that spends all this money. And can you afford to give it to somebody who might run it to the ground? It's like, but what's it for? Like, if you're just going to keep it running as this money, like, maybe you should risk, you know, take the risk. It's like if
art making's a risk,
right? Exactly. So anyway, so those are good stories. I would just say I want to call out something we didn't highlight enough, but it is linked in the story. I believe it's in both stories, actually. It's in both the Joe Hodge and the John Moore story. Rebecca Novick's online Google document, in which she is sharing the information, and she's inviting people to sort of enter information about what theaters have new positions open and what they've been filled with. And so far, it's been a lot of white men. There haven't been a lot of positions filled, but some of them have been filled. She's also listed the artistic search firms. I don't know if she's taken to the level of people like activism, like calling them, advocating to them or not, or she's just recording the information.
I think it's just recording the information, yeah, and then hoping people notice and do something
with it. She hasn't created a resist bot where you can start to tweet it.
Well, she did tweet at me saying American theater should cover this issue.
Right.
And I almost wrote back saying,
we are.
Wait for it. It's happening. It's happening.
I will say, you know, it was a sort of a perfect storm of Howard Sherman wrote a column in The Stage that was on a similar theme, and John Moore reached out to me and said, ah, I was writing something about that, and he beat me to it. And I said, well, let's see, what do you have?
Yeah.
And we were doing another story, which I'm teasing for our October issue. Deep was writing another story where Joe Hodge was part of me. He said, hey, would you be interested in this?
Running this op-ed for us.
Exactly. So,
and then he sent me the op-ed.
So sometimes we are in the right place at the right time, and we have this platform. We're happy to
share it.
Happy to share it, yeah.
But we should say what the stories are called, because
yes,
we have been yelled at for not setting things up properly.
Okay.
So thanks, everybody. Let's see. John Moore's story is called American Theater's Leadership Vacuum. Who will fill it? So you can find that on our website. And Joe Hodge's story is called Succession and Diversity Must Go Hand in Hand. So you can find the links to those things.
And find the links. And within those stories, you can find a link to Rebecca Novick's Google Sheet tracking all this. And Rebecca Novick just announced is going to direct a lecture at 10,000 Things in Minneapolis. So bring it all back to the theater. Another great show. You'll find links to everything on the page, and rate us on iTunes. Yes, don't let me step on your end of the show spiel. Deep, go ahead.
Links to the things that we talked about will be at americantheater.org. Rate us, review us. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. If you don't like us, don't say anything. Thanks.
All right, bye now.